And I'm really thrilled to welcome our next guest because we do spend a lot of time on this program talking about ethics and the ever-shifting landscape of ethical fluidity that we find ourselves in. Many people have called into the show talking about what do we tell our kids about decency and ethics when I tell my kid, don't be racist, respect women, don't grab women by the crotch, don't lie, do your homework, be prepared, don't mock handicapped people. And then we see all of that rewarded with the most power in the world. It's certainly a murky landscape, and it's an ever-shifting one, as you guys know all too well, which is why I was so excited when Eden Collinsworth's new book came across Neil's desk, Behaving Badly, The New Morality in Politics, Sex, and Business. I'm thinking John Lennon, forgive me. Ms. Collinsworth is a former media executive and business consultant who is president of Arbor House Publishing and founder of the LA-based monthly lifestyle magazine Buzz before becoming a vice president at the Hearst Corporation. That's your old job, Jorge. But of course, you might have heard of her previous book, I Stand Corrected, How Teaching Western Manners in China Became Its Own Unforgettable Lesson. None of that could have prepared me for her new book, which is all about what even is the relevance of morality today. And in the 21st century, what does morality, what do ethics really mean? What a pleasure to welcome Eden Collinsworth to SiriusXM Insight.
Well, thank you. Actually, I'm in London now, so I feel as though the Beatles connection is entirely appropriate.
Oh, well, I'm so pleased. Thank you very much. This is, I think what I like the most about your book is how unacademic it is, how non-scholarly it is. It's very, very conversational, and it really presents, through very entertaining, accessible prose, a lot of serious arguments about ethics, civility, and morality in these modern times of seemingly endless strife. What inspired this collection?
Well, you're absolutely right. I'm the first to admit that I'm not an ethicist. I'm not a social scientist. I don't have academic degrees to, that speak on behalf of this topic. But it actually became apparent to me in China that as a Westerner, I was operating with a very different set of moral values. And that prompted me to begin to contemplate whether or not my own personal values were, in fact, germane in my own country, in America. And so I started to explore, how to deal with this incredibly esoteric theme and subject. And it occurred to me that for me, the most enlightening way of grappling with the topic would be to interview other people, a very eclectic range of people who've made moral choices. And, I think you're absolutely correct in suggesting that when you tackle the topic of morality, you have to be, first of all, humble, but then you also have to find some semblance of humor. Otherwise, you're just going to be deadly, dreary, and boring.
So, believe me, that's true. Believe me. Do you see any sort of dovetailing between this notion of conventional notions of morality becoming passé and the decline of the influence of religion in American public life?
Oh, well, I think that's one part of a larger landscape, and I think it might be helpful to actually define for your listeners, certainly, define the word morality and also the word ethics, because it's often thought that they are one and the same, and in fact they're different. Morality is a personal set of beliefs. And it's fundamentally at the core of who we are as individuals. And ethics enables us to function in societal groups. And so it's expressed in the expectations and the sanctions also defined and enforced by a given culture or society. And so what is incredibly confusing and confounding, I think, today is that, we've never been so interconnected and global, and yet at the same time, so completely separate in terms of our ethical beliefs. And I think a great deal of certainly the ethical standards, if that's what you wish to call them, in America have been under siege. I mean, it feels like kind of a moral free fall. But I find great solace in also seeing now a pushback. And so there are consequences to lying. You know, when you lie, it's not only an issue of facts versus fiction, but it's also a moral issue. Mm-hmm. And I'm relieved to see that in fact, I think that we've hit our threshold of tolerance. And you know, the fact that the White House had to declare that the president is not a liar is really a sign of the times. But to answer your question specifically about religion, I think it's one of several components in this equation because, you know, the fact is that in my parents' generation, there was a belief that morality was a rule book, and I was instilled with that same belief, but that's simply not the case with the current generation. You know, their morals have been shaped by these, and sometimes dictated, frankly, by these profound changes brought about fundamentally, you know, the advancement of technology and science. Most of us don't understand, and many, frankly, couldn't have imagined. So I think it's a larger landscape. But I think you're absolutely right. The church is some part of that. It's I believe it's kind of, frankly, lost its plot.
Well, I'm excited to talk about some of the specific conversations and subjects you cover in the book. But just building on what you just said about the current generation, do you not see hope for a new kind of morality? I mean, we do see in many ways, yes, on the surface, our morals have gone down. We don't really have that compass that previous generations might have had. But at the same time, those old cultural structure breakdowns have led to all kinds of new forms of compassion. I kind of feel like you never would have had the movement for LGBT rights and dignity and equality a generation ago, young people who are fighting for climate change for purely moral mm-hmm. reasons, and even a resistance to torture we've seen in the last 10 years. I think for all these areas, you're exactly right, but do you see causes for hope that young people are adopting a very strong moral code, albeit a different one than you or I might have grown up with?
Yes, I'm very encouraged, you know, and relieved. And what is actually thrilling, regardless of whether or not I believe in the politics in terms of one party versus the next, certainly in the UK, as evidenced by this most recent election, the youth has found their voting voice.
You're right.
So now they're absolutely, you know, weighing in with a ballot, and that makes the difference. That changes everything. You also see it in France. I mean, you know, it's just absolutely remarkable. This man has literally come out of nowhere. There was no party. He created this party in less than a year. He is now the president of France, and he's pulled together an overwhelming majority in parliament with the most unlikely people. I mean, 50% of them have no political background. You know, they're a very wide variety of people who have achieved, and so he has galvanized in a way that I'm hoping America will do eventually. He has galvanized a populist movement in the center rather than on the fringes, and
right.
So we'll see what happens. I mean, now he has to actually implement policy, so we shall see what happens. But all of this is very encouraging.
Well, now that we've gotten the hope out of the way, let's get back to the messy stuff, because your book is totally fascinating, and there's something in here to challenge or inspire people from just about any background. But one of the first subjects of your book is a convicted murderer who sort of come to understand the concept of morality maybe a bit late in the game. And it's very clear that this person wasn't really taught any kind of moral code. As I grew in moral understanding, I began to realize what I had done. Can you tell us a bit about this story?
Well, it's a remarkable story. As is often the case, people's stories personal stories are sometimes more, you couldn't make them up in fiction. And certainly this was one such story. So this man made it very clear to me that there was absolutely no justification for the murders that he committed. That said, his was an absolute, a hopeless childhood. His mother was killed. His father was a violent alcoholic who beat him, and he ran away when he was 8, and he started to steal. And so all he knew was to steal. And as he grew older, he became slightly more sophisticated in that he threw his lot in with a group of older boys who, I think at that point he was a teenager, and they burglarized apartments. And so one of the murders occurred as a result of somebody coming home in the middle of the burglary, and another murder 3 months later was occurred actually in James Park, which is in the middle of central London, and a man was bludgeoned to death for his money. So both murders were the result of a botched burglary or hold up. The point is that he escaped. He was never pinned with either of these murders.
Mm-hmm.
So at no point was he identified as the murderer. He managed to leave the country, go to France, and join the Foreign Legion, where you can absolutely disappear. You take on another identity.
Right.
In a very rigorous training period, and it's the only military sector or organization that pledges allegiance not to the country but to itself. So there's great loyalty, and the point that he wanted to make to me was that he at that time he was in his early 20s, that he for the first time ever, he understood responsibility. He, the mechanics of being accountable, of taking on, a concern for more of his group rather than himself. The point is, he became a great leader,
right,
and was moved around. They sent him to the Congo. He, was in charge of other men, and as this progressed, he began to understand that the consequences of what he did. He became a moral agent at that point by recognizing what he had done, and he then became yet again a moral agent when he decided to give himself up, when in fact he had never been identified.
Wow.
So he accepted the consequences. He was sent back to the UK. He was tried and convicted and given a 23-year prison sentence, the first year of which was in solitary confinement. He was released several years ago, and so that was possibly the most difficult interview I had personally. I felt very ambivalent about it all, including, frankly, shaking his hand, knowing that he had strangled someone and then had also bludgeoned someone.
Yeah, I wondered about that, actually. Did you shake his hand?
I did. I shook his hand goodbye. And I, fundamentally when he asked me about morality, I suggested that I thought that it was what we chose to do. And sometimes we're cowardly, and other times we're remarkably heroic, but the choice is up to us. I don't think we're born moral beings. And so, the fact that he found his way to, nothing will ever make up for what he's done. He's obviously been the ruination of 2 families. He's not,
yes,
only killed 2 individuals, but he's brought, just a loop of misery, year after year, I would guess, to the people who knew and loved the 2 people he murdered. That said, he found his way to redemption, not, by the way, in a religious sense, but in a way that was, in his best efforts, you know, to rebuild his life. He now speaks to you know, at schools. He actually writes occasionally for The Guardian on prison reform. And the choice was either, frankly, to commit suicide or to find a way of you know, towards redemption. And it wasn't a an epiphany. It was a long, arduous, challenging you know, trip or voyage, so to speak, to get to that point.
Well, it's also interesting how much you go into modern business ethics, which I find to be a fascinating landscape, because for all the talk of corporate greed we do see in the HR offices of corporations, it's very often at the forefront of what constitutes ethics in the modern age. And some of the most progressive leadership in the country really is coming out of the corporate world.
I think that's right. And I think what's interesting now is the way corporate boards are held accountable. So I thought it was supremely ironic, frankly, that a board member of Uber had to resign because he had made, I gather, a wildly inappropriate comment about women, when in fact they have issues in that regard. So I think my sense, and, you know, this was very much a personal journey for me. I'm not suggesting that, you know, I've got the answers. But for me, it was, I was trying to sort through, you know, my own, how relevant my own moral values were. And for me, it was really quite interesting to understand what is transpiring in various sectors, one of which is the business sector. And I believe personally that a way of holding people accountable is to, you know, enforce a jail sentence. So fees are not necessarily effective, because quite honestly, if there's profit to be made, the fees are figured into the P&L, and so it's not an ethical decision. It's a financial one, looking at the profitability.
Does that then
so
lead
I'm
you?
I'm all for throwing people in jail, frankly.
But does that? But you know, we used to call prisons penitentiaries, a place to be penitent, or reformatories. Now they're cages. I mean, that leads us to all the ethical minefields around the modern for-profit prison system, too.
Yes, that's true. And, you know, it was interesting. I've lived many, many years outside of America. I was at one point the chief of staff of a global think tank, and the offices were, you know, in Moscow and in Washington and Brussels, and I did a lot of travel. And I've also lived on my own in China and France, and now the UK. And, you know, it's interesting to see there's just an entirely different take on everything, including prisons. When I was trying to sort out how to communicate with the man, you know, who had murdered two people, what was quite interesting to realize is that it's not allowed. You're not really allowed to go into prisons. But most to the point, when you get out of prison, it's a clean slate. You're not to be asked what you did. You are employable. You know, and so that's very different in America. You know, it for right or wrong, you're plagued with that, not only on your record, but at times, you know, it's difficult to settle or to be employed, gainfully employed anywhere. And it's the same with the health system. It's a very, very different attitude. The health system here in the UK, obviously it has its challenges, but they can't imagine how one can think of health and medicine as a profit center. They just don't get that.
Because ethically, we're kind of shaky. If you're just tuning in, our guest is Eden Collinsworth. She's the author of Behaving Badly, The New Morality in Politics, Sex, and Business. Our number here at Insight is 877-9-SIRIUS. And getting back to the business ethical world, you know, last week with the story of Reality Winner, the government worker who leaked leaked NSA secrets, and evoking Snowden and Chelsea Manning. You have a story in your book concerning an American whistleblower in a Japanese corporation who was shunned because they thought that him exposing corruption at the expense of loyalty to the corporation brought more shame on the company than the actual corruption he exposed. And that's the sort of thing we're seeing across politics and the corporate world now.
Yes. Well, I think it's this is why I was rather emphatic about defining ethics early in our conversation, because what is important to understand or to be reminded of is that, you know, the ethics occur within a cultural silo. And so that example was germane to the book because, and that particular chapter, because he was not, he's actually a British, he was the CEO of Olympus, not American, but
oh,
British,
so
but
sorry.
It doesn't matter.
No,
but
that's the worst thing you can do is call a British person American. It's very rude,
well,
I apologize.
Well, especially after the tweet that came in attacking the London mayor.
Yes, well.
Yeah, it was really very bad for him.
Yeah, that's a reality show star Americans don't want to claim either, but go ahead.
The point is that he had been in the corporation for some 30 years and was named CEO, but was a Westerner, obviously, in a situation that had an ethical, you know, had ethical reference points that he didn't share. And so he believed he was doing the correct thing by exposing malfeasance. And this was literally fraud that had been passed from one CEO to the next. I think there were three CEOs. It was like passed like a baton from one to the next. It was an accounting entry. And so as long as it wasn't admitted, in fact, you know, it could just continue to go on atmospherically. But by pointing it out and making it public, he was fired. But the point is that you're absolutely right. He was shunned not only by the Japanese press. He had to release the story to the Financial Times, which ironically is now owned by a Japanese company, but at the time it wasn't, and I'm sure that knowing the Financial Times, they still would have covered it. But the point is that he, you know, the press in Japan, the first instinct is to protect the corporations, and so too the people who work in those corporations, they're very loyal, and by admitting to this fraud, the stock, or pointing it out, the stock plummeted, and there were hundreds of people then who were fired because, of course, they then had to cut overhead. So in addition to being disloyal, it was felt that he was then responsible,
right,
for, you know.
But not the corruption he exposed.
No, that was, you know, it was just one thing was far more important to the other in terms of, you know, ethical behavior. And
right.
So, you know, that's a very interesting example of everything being relative.
Absolutely. Well, then let's talk about sexual morality, if we could, just for a minute, because you sure do go there in the book. And you know, I'd like to talk about, you know, more the liberalization of sexual mores. But first off, what you write about infidelity in some very interesting ways as well. What did your research change about the way you view that topic?
Well, I mean, I find this fascinating. You know, America has got to be, more than any other country I know, or certainly any other country in which I've lived, is a complete paradox when it comes to their attitude towards sex. Because, I mean, there's, according to, you know, my research, there is some, I don't know, 11% of women who are married have been unfaithful. And, you know, it's a higher rate. I think it's 15% among men. And yet, if you ask, you know, Americans whether they believe infidelity is immoral, 90% of them, or 92% of them, will say, yeah, absolutely. And yet at the same time, you know, some of the most profitable cable stations are, you know, basically offering soft porn. So it's a, you know, you can see where it's not necessarily what people believe, but how they behave that is, you know, sets the agenda. And what I was grappling with is, are the implications of technology. And so, you know, there are now portable electronic devices, so to speak, that provide this instant access to a greater number of potential sexual partners.
Indeed,
with the
they
least
do.
Amount, least amount of accountability.
Mm-hmm.
And so I did several things, one of which was to fly to Toronto and interview this man, Noel Bitterman, who had founded this company called Ashley Madison, which I believe has now changed its name. But the point is
yes.
that it's a...
The goal of my life, the goal of my life, by the way, is to have an adulterous affair with his wife, just so you know. That's my that's my ethical dream, but please go on.
God. Well, he insisted to me that, in fact, he was faithful, and of course he was not. So, you know, once a liar,
he wasn't faithful.
Always a liar.
If you read about all the bots he hired to pretend to be women, he wasn't faithful to his subscribers either.
Yes, no. Well, that is also another really interesting example of the take on morality, because when that website was hacked, and then there was the threat, and then shortly thereafter, the actual release of personal information. It was not for ethical reasons. It had nothing to do with, the hackers taking a position against infidelity. It was that the company had promised security online
yes.
and charged an equivalent of, I think it was $11 or $19 a month for that. And in fact, it was never in place. And so that was the reason they hacked and then released the information. But so this is a site that was launched very specifically to enable married people to have illicit affairs with other married people, regardless of to what degree he exaggerated women's
right.
membership. The fact was that there were it was interesting to me, their shift in marketing was targeted at, you know, to women, because there was a safe assumption that men have affairs or don't have affairs, but women, in fact, are more likely to be rather more thoughtful about it.
Well, but they're so thoughtful that most women who have affairs already know the guy they're going to have an affair with. They don't need to go online to a service.
Well, that could be. But what was really interesting to me, and I think this was still accurate information, even after it was revealed that he was exaggerating the numbers, was that the growing clientele in terms of the percentage, curiously enough, were not only women, but single women. And that is really what struck me as, for me personally, quite interesting, because I then began to wonder whether technology has allowed women to behave in ways that are natural, but whether it's sexual curiosity or a sexual appetite, and whether conventional morality has held that in check, and now what is releasing it, so to speak, is the technological opportunity,
mm-hmm.
or whether technology has encouraged women to possibly think outside of their natural inclination. So, you know, in my mother's time, you risked a great deal having sex before you were safely married, because that was before the pill. You could get pregnant, mm-hmm. then you were, you know, damaged goods. I was, had the benefit of the pill. That was my generation, and yet still, you were allowed to have lovers, but when it moved into double digits, you were kind of considered loose. Now, I don't think that there's any numerical designation for women, and that I find quite interesting.
I do too, but probably not for the same reasons you do. The book is fascinating, and I want to thank you for writing it, because you really are, aside from being a terrific writer, you're a great guide through this moral thicket, and I really thank you for all the stories you brought to us.
Thank you for having me on.
Of course, thank you. The author is Eden Collinsworth. The book is Behaving Badly: The New Morality in Politics, Sex, and Business. And how appropriate is this for a book on ethics? Maybe the greatest rock song ever that a guy wrote to seduce his friend's wife away from his friend. This is Eric Clapton singing about George Harrison's wife. Derek and the Dominoes played their first gig on this date in 1970 at London's Lyceum Theater. So ponder the ethics of this. We'll be right back. This is Insight.